Then I'd ask that you join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, who is Marilyn S. from Los Angeles.
Hello, I'm Marilyn Slater, and I am an alcoholic of the short variety. It's good to be here. Thank you, Lee, for the invitation to come and speak at this good meeting. I was just thinking, we were talking about events in Las Vegas, and a few years ago, I had to talk at the State Line retreat, and it's an event that occurs every year. And I had talked on Friday night, and then we had a nice dinner. And I was walking down the hall with two of my sponsees, one of whom was here last week, one was Sia. And I just said, I think I'm going to faint. And you know how blackness just comes up from the floor. And I fell on the nice carpet and passed out and threw up all over the rug. Now, I was completely sober. I'd been sober for many years. And so I didn't come to until paramedics had been called, and I had sort of a loose dress, and he was putting electrodes on my chest. He was so handsome, and I was kind of getting into it. And then his partner said, "Be careful, your knee is getting in the vomit," and that spoiled the mood. So I was thinking about that in the days that followed, and tonight, in fact. And a very similar thing happened when I was just getting into what we refer to as, it's always so funny, a drinking career. And getting into my drinking career, I loved alcohol. And I'd gone to a scientific meeting because I loved science, and that was my goal, to be a scientist, and I was a budding scientist. And so I'd gotten to go to a meeting on the East Coast, and there was a cocktail party. And I can remember that they had Manhattans, and they were so delicious. So I was drinking quite a few of them. And there was a scientist there of some repute, and he had given a paper. And somehow I decided to argue with him and tell him that he was all wrong. And I was poking my finger into his chest really hard. And at one point he said, "I've never met anyone like you in my life." And I thought it was a compliment. And then later in the evening, I fell on the floor and threw up all over the place. There was a visiting scholar in our lab from Germany, and he taught me a new word. The next morning, I just felt really, really bad. And he said, "Oh, you have a Katzenjammer." And that a long time ago, there used to be a comic, The Katzenjammer Kids. And that is hangover in German. So, Katzenjammer. That was the only useful thing I got out of that conference. But as I said, this was early in my alcoholism. And I was in a lab. I'd always wanted to be a scientist. I'd married a scientist. We were at UCLA. He was a physicist and doing his own research, and I was in a physiology lab. And these were fun days because we had gotten into the 60s. And if you're young and missed it, I feel sorry for you, because that was a time for people like us. Goodness. Everybody started drinking. There was a guy in our lab that was doing other stuff. He was mixing what he called a derivative of lysergic acid. Yeah, just later called acid. And so he would tell us he would pour this liquid on a filter paper and dry it and then cut it up into little squares. And he would say, "Now just put this on your tongue and wait. And then we'll go into the seminar, and it will bring out all the color in the slides." And so we'd go into the seminar, and they'd dim the lights and show slides, and then somebody would leap up screaming and run out. I guess too much color. But it was such a good time. There was a party that was in my husband's department. One of his colleagues was having a Halloween party. And so Bill and I went to the party, and I dressed in a harlequin costume, you know, with the funny hat with little bells and bright orange pants and a shirt with diamonds on it. And so I spotted the chairman of Bill's department, and Bill was new at the university, and I wanted to help him in his career. So I wanted to make a good impression on the chairman, and I wanted to explain to him that I, too, was a scientist, and that would help Bill, I felt. So I started talking to him, and it seemed like he wasn't terribly interested. So I got a little bit more emphatic. I wasn't quite poking him in the chest, but I had had quite a bit to drink, and I'm not sure that he could even understand what I was saying, but I was really trying. And then I noticed that somehow I was peeing in my pants, and I had on bright orange pants. So it was pretty obvious, and a puddle was forming on the floor. I hate when that happens. And the chairman just kind of backed off and turned and walked out of the room, and there I was standing in this puddle, and I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I ran out the back door, but there was a 6-foot cinder block wall that prevented me from scaling it and running home. So I just sat there completely depressed, so sad. And there was a dachshund in a playpen. And that dachshund was whimpering and seemed so sad. And so I thought, I'll go over and cheer up the dachshund. So I just reached in to pet the poor creature. And that thing snapped its jaws down on my hand. And I ripped my hand out, pulling the skin way back, and I was standing there with blood dripping out of my hand. So what do I do now? I thought I'd better go back in. And this is the luck of the alcoholic. I went in and nobody noticed my wet pants. I just got whisked off to the ER, and they sewed up my hand, and people called, and they asked, how's your hand doing? I mean, nobody mentioned pants. So I was saved for more fun. These were the fun days. And in my lab, too, we'd drink. There was lab alcohol. In fact, that was one of our chemicals that we used, 90% ethanol. And that's a very good drink. I mean, that's 180 proof. So we'd drink in the lab, and then we'd go out to bars at night. There was a wonderful bar called the Oar House with big oars over the door, and down in Venice, and there was sawdust on the floor. The Matador was another one. Sadly, it became the Islands with hamburgers, but in my day, it was the Matador where flamenco dancers would get up on the table with castanets, and I just felt like, this is international travel. This is so terrific. And one night we had been out to some of these bars, and I was with some of the people from the lab, and we went down to the sea, down to Malibu, and it was winter, so it was kind of chilly. But the air was very clear, and there were lights across the sea, and I just knew that's Catalina Island. And it was calling to me. Come to me. So I just jumped into the sea and started swimming to Catalina. Now, I wasn't cold because I was wearing a heavy coat. My lab mates seemed not to have been drinking as much as I had, and so they were standing on the shore watching what was going on, and they quickly began to form a human chain. And a few waded in and dragged me back onto the shore and rolled me into the trunk of the car and drove me home and got me up to the door, rang the doorbell and drove away quickly. And my long-suffering husband came to the door, and I was this big wet mass that just thumped down onto the living room floor. And so he was beginning to notice, and he said, I thought you were going to be at your lab working. And I said, oh, I was. Oh, yes. But then we just stopped to look at the ocean. So this was life. And then there were days in the lab, too. Our second step talks about being restored to sanity. And alcoholism, of course, implies a certain amount of insanity, because we drink ourselves to death. There is everything about life that likes to persist. It likes to ensure safety. But we as alcoholics know that we're dying, and yet we seem not to resist that. So that's insane. But another aspect of this kind of insanity for me was that while I was drinking there in the lab, I just felt like I am doing super science now. I mean, I'm probably going to win the Nobel Prize. This is fantastic. I was working on muscle protein, what causes muscles to contract. And I was doing a lot of work in a great big refrigerated room. Now, my research didn't need that, but my cases of beer did. And so I would store it there, and I'd put on a parka in the morning and mittens and go in to do careful scientific work with big mittens on. Now, it's a little bit difficult to carefully pipette and do other things, but I could get those beer cans open. And as long as I could do that, I just knew that my work is going ever so well. Now, the director asked me, how's it going? How's your work going? And I would always say, just fine. And he would say, do you need any help? And I would say, no, it's just fine, because it felt fine. And then one day he said, I want you to write up what you've been doing and give us a talk, a lab talk, and let us know what about this wonderful work that you're doing. Goodness. What could that mean? Well, I looked through my lab books, and I had drawn some pictures of lab mice and written a few limericks. There was a young man from Nantucket. But I couldn't find anything on my research. Apparently, I hadn't written anything down about muscle protein. It seemed like I had been working there, but there was just nothing to show for it. And now, clearly, I was an alcoholic by that time, probably always was, because at the moment I started drinking, I knew this is for me. But I was well advanced into drinking. I was losing my career because of drinking. So the obvious thing would be to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think I even knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, but had I done that, I could have gone to the director and thrown myself at his mercy and said, I am so sorry, I have squandered this opportunity. I am sober now, could you give me another chance? I had no coping skills. So what I did was, when he asked me to write up what I'd been doing, I just went home and sat on the couch and mailed the keys back sometime later without any explanation. I had no idea what to do. Well, I did have an idea what to do, and that was to go get something to drink, which I did. And so the years that followed were ones where I drank pretty much steadily. And I was getting sicker and sicker because I had lost my career. Bill was working hard day and night. I was at home, plenty of time to drink. I managed to keep one skill, and that was how to get to the store and buy more to drink. And there was a time when I just knew that there's something wrong with me. It didn't occur to me that I was drinking too much, but I knew I had some kind of dreadful disease and maybe I'd better see a doctor. And I made an appointment to go see a doctor, and he did some tests, and I went back a few days later, maybe a week later, to get the diagnosis, because I knew it was something terrible, probably something very exotic that he might want to write a scientific paper about. So I sat down, and he kind of leaned forward, and he said, "Mrs. Slater, I've got some good news." Now, I was crazy and very confused anyway, but I felt, I mean, what does it mean, good news? What could that be? He said, "You are pregnant." And all I could do was blurt out, "Oh my gosh, I wonder if it's mine." And it was. And and before long, there was this little child, a little baby in the house. And I was unable to take care of anything, really. And Bill was getting pretty worried. He would come home, and I think the baby was in her crib. But the next morning, he said, "I came home, and you were passed out on the kitchen floor." And I said, "I think it was that ice cream I was eating. You know how you get that brain freeze? And I guess I just passed out." And he said, "You were in an alcoholic stupor." And I thought, that is mean. That is cold. How can he talk to me like that? But he went to work, and I went out, got more to drink. And somehow during this time, I had lost all control of my life. Before long, it seemed like the house was filling up with more little children. It seemed like lots of them, like six. It turned out there were only three, but I'd watch them, and they moved fast, and I couldn't count them. And but Bill was very, very worried, so he brought his mother in, my mother-in-law, and I loathed and hated her because she replaced me. I was altogether dependent on Bill and this my mother-in-law. But of course, I resented them terribly because they had taken my place. My mother-in-law talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it scared me. I hid from her. I took solace in the garage. I used to sit in the garage and drink, and a family was going on inside the house. I looked down at the floor, and there were, every day, ants coming in, trails of them, and I watched them and I studied them, and I just looked at them, and I thought, these simple creatures, I mean, they have friends, they have jobs, they have a sense of purpose, and I missed it all. I mean, how can it be? I never wondered why there were so many of them, but after I got sober, I realized that I was kind of like that person in the movie Airplane that had a drinking problem. You know, he'd miss his face a lot of the time. And that's what I was doing in those later stages of my alcoholism. I would just pour my drink, mostly beer in those days. That was that all-purpose drink. And it would evaporate on the floor. And beer is full of all kinds of wonderful sugars. And that would be left behind for the ants. And it was party time every day. So they would come in and join me. And I was talking about that one night, and somebody said, "Boy, you really did sink to lower companions." But they were my friends, and I don't hurt them to this day. They stood by me, so I stand by them. My mother-in-law would encourage me. She would say, "Unless you stop drinking and get control of your life, we're going to lock you up and you'll never see the children again." You know, encouragement. And I just wanted to say to her, "How dare you talk to me like that? I mean, this is my garage, you know." But she meant business, and she scared me. I took a trip into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1969. But that's not my sobriety date. I just went because I knew that the heat was on at home, and my mother-in-law was relentless. Now, as I said, I did not appreciate her, but she saved the children's life. Before she came, I would put them in the car and drive out to get more to drink. And now she reminded me who I was, so that's why I had to loathe and detest her so much. I could see what I had become in her eyes. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, not to get sober, not even thinking that I had what everybody else had in the fellowship. I just went to get her to go away and leave me alone. So I went to meetings for about 3 months. And during that time, I stayed sober. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. I didn't really do much of anything. I just kind of sat in the back and I kind of watched. I heard stories, but they didn't make any sense to me. What I seemed to hear was, my life was a wreck. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I stopped drinking, and I've never had a bad day since. And people would talk about things, and there was always something in the story. I came out of a blackout, and I was in Singapore. Well, I never did that, so I'm not an alcoholic. There was always two or three things that would let me know that my case was truly different. But I was staying sober, just somehow peer pressure, the power of this fellowship. I didn't drink. And that impressed my mother-in-law, and she, actually it was a combination, my mother and mother-in-law would alternate, the two grandmas. So after I'd stayed sober for about 3 months, they all went home and left the house to me because they thought that I had been cured, and that was wonderful. Now, while I was there in that fellowship, as I said, I didn't really take the steps, I didn't understand what the program was, but I watched people. There was a meeting that I was always taken to. Pretty soon somebody would say, "You are mighty intense. We know a group that's right for you." And they would take me to the big Pacific group in West Los Angeles. And so I'd look at the people there. It was full of activity and lights and clapping and shaking hands and horrible questions. Do you have a sponsor? Do you have a home group? How many meetings do you go to? And so there was a fellow, Clancy, that seemed to be the group leader, and he was scary. So I stayed away from him. And there was another person, Marion, and she seemed to be a goddess. She didn't seem to walk on legs. She would just come into a room. She would kind of just float in, and people would surround her, and she had a sense of humor, a sense of purpose, and clearly people loved Marion. And I wanted to know Marion. I was waiting for her to come over and say something like, "I saw you from across the room, and you fascinate me. I'd like to get to know you." And I was waiting, and she never did that, so I never got to know her. I never said hello, but I remembered Marion. But all of that was pretty useless because I went home after the adult supervision left. And so once I got back home, it was okay for a few days. But then around 4 o'clock, I knew that Bill would be coming home. He'd come home and he'd expect food. And it meant that I would have to make it. Sometimes I would think, why doesn't he bring it home? But he was working hard in his lab, and it was left to me. And I just thought to myself, you know, if I could have a couple of drinks, I bet I could do that. I know I could. But I've been to those meetings, and I don't think I really have what other people have, whatever this alcoholism is. But I might have a tendency in that direction, so I had better be careful, and I could make rules, and I will make the rules. I can have 2 drinks, and that did the trick. I was able to make a dinner, and Bill came home, and there was food for him and food for the children, and everybody was happy. I was happy, and it worked. But then Bill always went back to work every evening. And now there seemed at some point to be three little children. And they needed beds and baths and stories, and they all had to be done in the right order. And it was just more than I could understand and cope with. I mean, I could sometimes get them down in bed, and then one would pop up to get a drink. No, stay down, I'll get you something to drink. And the other one would jump out of bed. I gotta pee, just like whack-a-mole. And I thought, you know, if I could just have two more drinks, I could do this. And that worked. It worked so well. Oh my goodness. We just all end up in bed together. A lot of empty bottles and beer cans. Oh my gosh. I was enjoying that so much. And then I was coming out of a blackout in the garage. How did I get from bed with children to garage? And the adult supervision was back. My mother, my mother-in-law alternating to make sure the children were safe. Now, we hear that this disease that we have, this alcoholism, can progress whether we're drinking or not. And I know that to be true because I have seen it happen quite a few times, sadly. I'm in a big group, and some of our members have gone out after many years of sobriety, and many of them do not make it back. But many of them die or get into the late stages of alcoholism and have to be institutionalized for the rest of their lives very quickly. And somehow, after all those years of sobriety, the disease has progressed. Well, that happened to me. It was a very short time before I was drinking as much as I had been drinking before, and worse. And I don't remember much about the 2 or 3 years, but I was getting to that place where I just knew that I am hopeless. I'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and instead of thinking, you know, tomorrow I'm going to cut back on my drinking, tomorrow I'm not going to drink. Now it was, I'm going to wake up and I am going to drink. And I'm going to drink and die and probably take others down with me. And I was reaching that state of hopelessness and desperation that I think many of us have to get to before we admit that we need help. And sadly, I think many people, well, my thought for a long time was, if I ever get bad enough, I can go to that fanatic organization. That's another aspect, I think, of what we talk about in being restored to sanity. The insanity of alcoholism is that illusion that while I am drinking, I have control of this. Of course I do. I could stop anytime I want to. I just don't want to. And if it ever gets bad enough, I could do something about it. Well, I was really drinking into a blackout every day now and was very sick. In fact, I went to the doctor, and this time it was bad news. The doctor said, your liver enzyme panel indicates that you are a chronic alcoholic, and I suggest that you need to be detoxed, probably hospitalization, and I can admit you to a hospital. That is what you need, because with this kind of test results, you probably don't have a lot of drinking time left, and you really need a full workup and detox. Well, I thought he was insane, and so I never went back to see him again. I just went home and drank more. But I was very sick by that point and very, very lonely. The ants just weren't doing it for me. And there were no people in my life that I could talk to except for the people at Central Office. Somehow I knew I could call them and they'd talk to me for a little while. Not very long, but because they'd usually say, do you have a drinking problem? And of course I would always say no, but I'm lonely and I need somebody to talk to me. Will you talk to me? And sometimes they would talk with me. And one morning, this person was very kind. She understood that I was lonely, and I told her I didn't drink, but I just needed somebody to talk to me. And she said, well, let's talk. And then after we talked for a while, she said, how much do you drink? And I said, oh, I told you, I don't drink. I just need somebody to talk to me. And she said, okay, and we talked. And then she said, have you had a drink yet today? And I said, I gotta go now. And she said, don't go, don't go. And she got my address and she sent somebody to talk to me. And that was the wonderful Lorena, who's sober in Ojai, well over 50 years. And she came to see me February 8, 1972, and that is my sobriety date. She said she would take me to a meeting. And I said, I don't think I need that. And she said, oh, you probably don't. But you see, I do, she said, because she told me her story, which was a sad story. She had lost her job and she jeopardized her family. Goodness, sadness. But then she got real happy and said it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But she has to go to meetings. So she said, I usually go with my friend and I don't have enough time to pick up my friend now. And I can't go alone. Just go with me. And I said, well, I'm sure you can go alone. I don't really need to do that. Oh, I understand, but I know that I can't go alone, she said. Just come along with me. Just ride with me. Well, I mean, my sense of nobility kind of rose to the surface, and I thought, I've got to help out this poor person. All right, I'll ride along with you. So we went to this little place in Santa Monica, Serenity Manor, 26th and Broadway in Santa Monica. We got out of the car and walked up the steps, and I said, here, I'll just sit on the porch. You can go into your meeting, and I'll wait for you. She said, oh, no. The scariest part is walking through the door. Just walk through the door with me. And I said, you could go through the door. It's easy. Just open the door. She said, no, this is the scary part. Please, just walk through the door with me. All right. As I said, I had to be noble. I had to help her out. So I stepped inside with her, and she grabbed my hand and pulled me right up to the front row and said, sit. Well, I seemed not to be able to escape. And the first part of the meeting took place. I don't know what it was. But then the leader got up and said, tonight, our main speaker is Marion. And there was that goddess of sobriety that I had wanted to meet before. Probably the only person that I wanted to know. Probably the only person I thought could ever help me. And there she was, somehow the speaker at that first meeting that I was taken back to. Now, I have no idea how that happened. That was just one of many coincidences that have been very important in my recovery. But I came into the program as an atheist. I thought, I believe in science. Science can explain everything that needs to be explained. And if you can't do experiments on it, it does not exist. So all this supernatural business, the idea of God, or what the fellowship talk about, the higher power, spiritual beings, it all fit into this category of mystical creatures like Santa Claus or Easter Bunny. And I just thought, it doesn't make any sense to me. You can't touch it or feel it or do experiments on it. But on the other hand, because of that remarkable coincidence, which just was so beyond probability, I thought there is some mystery here. And I still believe that. I don't know how a higher power works in our fellowship. The difference between then and now is that I know that it does. Like our second tradition talks about, a loving God, as he expresses himself in our group conscience, I believe it is so much more profound than business meeting where group conscience gives us God's will. I believe that this higher power pervades the whole fellowship, and somehow it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, think about a gathering of alcoholics, like in a bar. I mean, people get beat over the head with a chair. It usually is not in the direction of health, but in this fellowship, somehow we all come together and we invoke this higher power and we take up our beds and walk. We begin to pass for normal in the real world. So that was my first inkling that there is something beyond human power, just that remarkable coincidence. And Marianne talked, and she talked about fear and a husband that she was no longer married to him, but an unhealthy dependency. And I realized my unhealthy dependencies, how I was so dependent on these people to take care of the children, to take care of me, really. And it was shameful. And it was unhealthy. And I heard my story when Marianne talked. That was identification. There was a wonderful person, Father Terry, in Los Angeles that used to give a lot of retreats. And one of the things that he often said was, identify, don't compare. And that made all the difference in the world between my two visits to Alcoholics Anonymous. That first time around, I compared myself with the stories I heard and realized that this doesn't apply to me. But when Marianne talked, I identified. She told my story. That leader in the group, Clancy, used to say this, and I paraphrase it, but that if we are lucky enough to hear our own story, it may reduce this feeling of difference enough so that we begin to take steps that we ordinarily wouldn't take. And that is when sobriety begins. And so at this meeting, I heard my story. And I ran up and I asked Marianne to be my sponsor. I wasn't waiting for her to find me. She said it would be a privilege. Now, what other club could you go into? Like the Rotary Club, PTA, Country Club, those animal clubs like Elks, Eagles, Lions. Just walk up to a complete stranger and say, would you take care of my life? Would you let me call you at 3 o'clock in the morning? Maybe sometimes lend me some money. Just listen to story after story of my misery. What they would say is, security! But Marianne said it would be a privilege. But she insisted that I go to her home group, and that was the big Pacific group. That one that had scared me so that first time around. But this time I went willingly. And I needed something like that because I was coming out of a dark garage with ants. And so it really structured my life. And she wanted me to go to 7 meetings a week, which I did. At first I said I can't because I have these little children and I can't go out every night. And she said, you can get a babysitter. And she told me how to do that. Now, that was 1972. There was no internet. And the way you get a babysitter, or at least this is how she told me to, was to write out my need on an index card. And you go to the local grocery store, and with a thumbtack, you tack it up on the bulletin board. And that's how we, that was Facebook in those days. So I put the index card up, and a high school kid volunteered, and he became a wonderful babysitter. He'd come over every evening, and do his homework so Bill could go back to work and I could go to a meeting. And I began to stay sober day after day, week after week. Of course, I took the steps. I tried to follow along. This whole God business was, as I said, very mysterious to me because I thought in terms of reason and science. But there was the great Chuck Chamberlain that often visited our group. He was the sponsor of Clancy, who was the group founder and leader. And so he would come back on Clancy's birthday, and he spoke a lot in West Los Angeles, and I became a groupie. He was so remarkable. He talked about God as the pappy. He's the pappy, and we're his kids, he would say. And he talked about infinite father, infinite child. There's always going to be as much ahead of us as there is right now. That's what infinity is, forever. Infinite father, infinite child. And clearly he knew some very big thing. And I wanted to know that. I wanted to know that thing that Chuck was talking about. I was taking the steps, and that caused deep emotion to come to the surface, kind of dark night of the soul. For about that second year to my third birthday, a lot of deep emotion coming up and finding resolution, resentment, grief, anger, all of this negative stuff. And I'm sure it was helped out by taking the steps. That's what the steps do, of course. Cause us to drop that rock, as Sandy B would say, or cause us to find out who we are and sort out in 6 and 7 what needs to be kept and what we have to allow God to, what kind of surgery we allow God to do. That's steps 6 and 7. Were a real turning point because I had come to know that I was pretty hopeless and helpless to do anything about who I was. And I was so disgusted with who I was. I told lots of lies. I was fearful of everything. I hated the world. I felt that I'd been mistreated by so many people. And all of that came out in an inventory, and it just made me feel sad. I think that if our program ended with the fourth step, we'd leap off of cliffs like lemmings and jump into the sea. But we've got all of these other steps, though, that seem to begin to get us back on track and, well, into a whole new track. 6 and 7 are interesting because they come halfway between from steps 1 to 12, they're right in the middle. And it's that point where I think we stop looking inward and what can I do to make myself happy? How can you be kind to me? How can I get just what I always wanted? Sort of the zero sum game. If I win, then you have to lose and vice versa. To that thing of giving it all over to a higher power, like that lovely seventh step prayer. My creator, I'm now willing you can take all of me, good and bad. I don't know what's good, I don't know what's bad. You can have it all. And take away whatever it is that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. That kind of thing where we begin to look outward and allow somehow this higher power to enter in. Well, I had come to believe that Chuck C. knew some big thing. And I had come to believe that maybe it would act in that step 7. Maybe I could be changed. And one day I just said to outer space, really, if you're there, I'd like to get to know you. And if you're really there, I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me. And my heart started beating fast because I thought, I have just signed a really big contract. Because I had begun to think something's there and something's listening and will probably take me seriously. But then my other thought was, this is a disappointment because I had seen plenty of movies like The Ten Commandments and Charlton Heston, and you know, I kind of expected music, maybe lightning bolts. Well, there was nothing like that. but over a period of time, this reconciliation, this resolution of deep emotion, the steps were doing that job that needs to be done. I don't believe that we can experience a higher power until some of that debris is cleared away. And around my third birthday, the veil parted, and it was, you've been there all along, haven't you? I could see when I could see, but not a moment before. And that's stayed with me ever since. The steps do another thing, too. I think it makes us, as I said, we pass for normal in the real world. So I was able to go back to work and back to school. And it was funny, I made amends to the director of that lab. He just acted embarrassed, and I was embarrassed. But a few years later, he called and offered me a job. So I went back to the scene of the crime and had a chance to make living amends there. I'm quite a klutz in the lab. I really thought, now that I'm sober, maybe I'll win the Nobel Prize now. But that was not to be. I continued to break glassware and cause some explosions. And so everyone was happy when I changed careers. I still stayed with science. I went into something using computers, biometrics, or medical, using computer data to organize scientific information, so I could always be close to it. And in these later years, I've been teaching science at a lifelong learning institute, so I'm at always a safe distance. I stay out of the lab, and everybody stays safe. But the wonderful thing is that I have come to see that it's all one. At first I thought there was reason, and then I thought there was supernatural. And reason you could do tests on and experiments. But what about the supernatural? Now I see it all as one. And it's a funny thing. I realized in teaching a course on cosmology, there's dark energy and dark matter. And it makes up 95% of the universe, strangely. And what we can see, like stars and moons and planets and people and dogs, cows, that makes up about 5%. So you would say, my gosh, you can't see or measure or do experiments on 95% of the universe? Then how do you know it's there? And a cosmologist would say, because of its effects on what you can see. And somehow I thought, it's the same thing in the fellowship. We can't touch or feel, experience God and do experiments on God or call God to do our agenda, but we can see the effects that it has. One person after another staying sober day after day, week after week, year after year. And that's every bit as convincing as we hear the cosmologist talking. So I've come to appreciate science and supernatural as being all one and the same. It's all a great, big, beautiful, mysterious universe. And the more I understand about the complexity of living systems and the immensity of the universe, the more I appreciate the higher power that acts in our fellowship. And what is so amazing is that this higher power seems to like us. I mean, there's a lot of alcoholics I don't like. But this higher power, I mean, we're sort of the chosen people that God has taken great pity on us. That is very mysterious, but it's wonderful. So, as I said, I became civilized enough to go out and work again and go back to school and start this new career. And life was really good. The children were growing up. It was Becky, David, and Susie, our two girls and a boy. And they began to, our two daughters began to have children, and so those were grandkids. I kind of missed it that first time around, so now we had these little grandbabies. And that was fun. And then David, our son, became a scientist like his dad, and Bill was so proud. Life was so normal and good that I just thought it's going to run out the clock. And then when I was 40 years sober, I was at State Line. Whenever I'm at State Line, something goes wrong. I mean, that was the time when I collapsed on the floor and threw up. So I was at State Line. And had to talk on Friday night. And before I sat down, I looked at my phone, and there were a lot of calls from family members. And they couldn't find David. His young wife said he always comes home from work on Friday night, and he hasn't come home. Have you heard from him? No, I hadn't. And his two sisters were trying to reach him. We couldn't find David. So I went to my room and was staying in touch with the family. Bill had not heard from him. We were all scattered all over the place. And so Aaron, his young wife, had called the police, and they were reluctant to go, but she said, he is always home on Friday night. I know that something dreadful has happened. So they went to his office, and indeed they found that he had hanged himself in his office. Now, he seemed to have the good life, a wonderful career, a beautiful young wife, a little stepson whom he had bonded with. We'll never know. He didn't leave a note. We'll just never know why that happened. But my world came to an end that night. And luckily, by that time, I had a very strong sponsor. Clancy had become my sponsor, and he'd been my sponsor for quite a while, the person I had feared so much. And yet I just realized that he is such a wonderful example. And so, of course, I called Clancy. He happened to be at State Line, too, giving a talk that same weekend. And he said, you have 40 years of sobriety. You can be that strong force in your family. And the program will sustain you, and you must go home and sustain your family. You'll have a couple of years of hard grief, but you will get through. And when I was talking that night, there was one thing that I said. I think I was talking about the second step, and just somehow I said, I know in extremis God meets me about 90% of the way. Now, I don't know why I said that, but I found that that was true. Because I had a CD in the car. Bill told Clancy said to go home, which meant driving about 5 hours across the desert that night. And I had a CD to listen to, and it was the great Sandy Beach. I use his last name because he's passed on. And he had lost his two daughters the year before. And he said, I hope that you never have to experience anything like that. But if you do, I'm going to tell you what I did and what I suggest that you do. You go out to your higher power and you say, don't abandon me, don't leave me, and I won't leave you. And you sign that contract even deeper. And then when you get back and do begin to react deeply, guess who comes back with you? And I practiced that in the car and went out to my higher power. And I can tell you that that is true. I was never abandoned. And that was manifest largely through the fellowship, my home group. Somehow, we are a big grapevine. That word seemed to get out immediately that we had experienced this loss. And when I went to my home group, I was wrapped up in the love of the fellowship. And somehow, I knew I'm going to make it through. There were other people. I would have felt like I was the only one that something like this had happened to, but there was Sandy and a person in our group, Julie St. Jay, had lost her son 10 years before, and I knew about that. I had gone through that with her, and I knew she was okay. So example after example of, you can get through anything. Indeed, we can. But there were a couple of years that were just hard, hard grief. I began talking after about 60 days and telling my story, and again, kind of convinced that this just never has happened to anybody else. And somebody came through the line who had just lost a child to suicide. And that's happened time and time again, that every time I talk and tell my story, I realize that tragedy visits all of us, ultimately. Not always the same thing, but that's just as much a part of life as the joy, as the successes, the celebrations, especially if you live a long time. Of course, there were to be many more losses in my life because I am very old. This program has kept me sober now for 53 years, and I am 85 years old, so, but I'm still spry. But what Julie, who had lost her son, told me, if you can just accept, you will find that there are many, many blessings. And I thought, how could there be blessings? Well, there have been many blessings just by surviving, just by staying around. And the first one is that I listen. I listen to my sponsees. I listen to family members a lot more. What did we miss about David? Why didn't we hear that somehow life was so unbearable to him that he had to stop it? So I listen. The other thing was a kind of resilience for hard times that come. I think the worst of all possible things happened to me. Nothing could be this bad. There is a resilience. 5 years ago, Bill crossed over, passed away. Before he left, I took care of him for quite a while. He was on hospice care, a long lingering illness. And one night, toward the end, he was still lucid. He just looked up and I was saying goodnight to him and telling him I loved him. And he said, perfect marriage. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've been forgiven. The slate is clean. This is so sweet. And he said, oh, not quite perfect. I know, I was a witch or something that rhymes with it. And then he said, because it only lasted for 60 years. And so I hold that close to my heart. He said he would meet me on the other side. He had come to believe, because I think of my own belief, my own experience in this fellowship. And that probably will be true. I certainly know that this goes on, as Chuck C. said, infinite father, infinite child. It goes on forever. As Bill Wilson says, we're fine in the here and the hereafter. A year later, we lost Clancy, August 24th, about 4 years ago. And I just thought, well, it's time for me to leave this earth because I'm old, and what could be left? There just can't be anything more. It's been a long life. It's been fine. And I've been kept sober. But that was not to be. I thought I could certainly never find another sponsor. I'm old, I'm sober a long time, sober longer than most people in my home group. I'll never have another sponsor. Well, 2 weeks after Clancy passed away, I was in a retreat with Father Tom W., who does a lot of retreats, and I've been a groupie forever, and I go to a lot of his retreats, and have learned so much from him, so much respect for him, but just saw him as that Catholic priest and retreat leader. But somehow, right in the middle of his talk, he said, you know, I'll sponsor anyone. They often don't call me, but I'll sponsor them. And I thought, this is my chance. He would be a wonderful sponsor. So I wrote him a note. This was during the pandemic, and he just said, yes, here are the numbers. And that has been a great relationship. He is a wonderful sponsor. I have learned so many things. I've come to appreciate Mary Oliver, the poet. He reads a lot, so I've learned many new books to read. But I think what has been most valuable is that I have been drawn into his community of friends. And we have had great times together. when Clancy passed away, at the same time the matriarch of our group also died, Millie, leaving behind so many orphans. So I began to sponsor a lot of these orphans, and I had to find a new sponsor. We all had, it was like musical chairs with sponsorship. Goodness. And so we all got sorted out, and I began to sponsor some very active people, more active than I am, actually. But it has just been a joy for me. One of them, Debbie, up in Concord, she and her husband like to travel, and so sometimes they invite me to come along, and it's usually an AA trip that involves a lot of AA when we're gone, and we've gone to Japan and to Egypt and other places, and so we went to Egypt together, and we went to a couple of meetings and took a lot of literature. But while we were there, I got to ride a camel. Here's Grandma on a camel. And we got to go in pyramids. And one of them, I went into this giant pyramid at Giza with another couple that was traveling with us. And I was having a great old time. You go upstairs, and you go downstairs, and you go into these chambers with hieroglyphics on the wall. And you crawl through tiny spaces on your hands and knees. Oh, it's such an adventure. And somehow the couple was just not enjoying it as much as I was, it seemed. And I said, what's wrong? This is fun. And they said, well, it could be, but we're just a little worried. I mean, you're so old. And I mean, you know, you might have a heart attack and die. And how do we get you out of here? Well, I see the problem, but I said, think of where we are. I mean, this is a pyramid. It's basically a tomb. Just leave me here. It's perfect. And so then they got happy, and well, actually, we all got out and on to other things. In these last years, as I said, I've always missed David. I thought that he would be there in my later years. I have our two daughters, and they have been so much fun. It's such a great support. But I miss David, of course. And a little over a year ago, I got a call from one of the grandsons, Adam, and he is such a dear fellow. He called up and he said, I just graduated from college, and I got a job in downtown LA. Could I move in with you? And I said, of course you can. Of course you can. I would love to have you. So he's been living there with me now for over a year. And he's not ashamed to be out with Grandma. We just went to a concert together the other night. And it's such a joy. And he has filled that spot that I thought that David might fill. He's not David. He's very much Adam. But it is that second opportunity to have that in my life. He had been going with his girlfriend from college, and he was sad because she was still in Iowa. So I said, well, you know, she could move in. So Samantha moved in too. So now I have both of them there, and they are so in love. And they're going to get married in May. Now, I became a universal life minister. I'm just Reverend Marilyn. And so I'm going to perform the ceremony, and that will be fun. It will be my third. I have married two of my sponsees. So if you're planning a wedding, I mean, I offer my services. That is great fun. So this program has given me all of these things that I need. And I'm so glad that it hasn't given me the things that I want, because I've always wanted something that's really terrible. There's a saint, Saint Teresa of Avila, and she said, the greatest number of tears are shed over answered prayers. And so I understand that. But my life is very full. I often quote the poet Browning. He's not conference approved because he lived before Alcoholics Anonymous was. but I think that it describes the path that I have followed. He said, grow old along with me. The best is yet to be, the last of life for which the first was made. It's all preparation, isn't it? And the best is yet to be. Thank you.
Marilyn, another hand.